Welcome to Soundcast, a series about the food we eat. We're going to spend the next year examining the entire system of how food gets to the farm to your table, including the history, politics, health, and environmental concerns, and the economics of wholesome food. You're already familiar with some of the issues. Our neighborhoods have become food deserts, with not a supermarket to be seen around us for miles. Our children are unhealthy with type 2 diabetes and high blood pressure showing up at younger and younger ages. Many of us die too young from preventable diseases. We believe it doesn't have to be this way. Over the coming year, we're going to share stories about our food. We'll explore how farms, both urban and rural, can feed and employ our people, how we can get fresh produce to our citizens, how we can take care of the environment, and how we can create a 21st century food system that is more just and healthier for each of us and our world. We believe it can be done. Please join us as we explore how we get there together. This week on the show, we look at the drugs we feed to animals and how they affect human health. Up first, Dr. Lance Price joins us to talk about the risk that feeding antibiotics to animals will reduce the potency of the life-saving drugs when we need them to heal people. Dr. Price is the director of the Center for Microbiomics and Human Health at the Translational Genomics Research Institute in Flagstaff, Arizona. He studies the links between the use of antibiotics in animal feed and the development of drug-resistant bacteria. Then we'll hear from Dr. Keith Nachman from the Farming for the Future program at the Center for a Livable Future at Johns Hopkins. He joins us to talk about a bill that recently passed the Maryland Senate and House that bans the drug Roxasone from chicken feed in the state. Up first, here's Dr. Lance Price. I asked him to talk about why it's important to fight antibiotic-resistant bacteria.
There's this complacency and arrogance that's built on our reliance on antibiotics. You know, we've had antibiotics in human medicine for 70 years. And, you know, all of us in this room grew up with them.
Right.
You know? And so we're just complacent about bacterial infections. You know, when I published this study on staph and food about a year and a half ago, I try to stay off of the blogs, but I looked at a few, you know, and people would make these arrogant, stupid statements like, oh, bacteria are everywhere, blah, blah, blah. This is staph aureus, you know, and infects hundreds of thousands of Americans a year, you know, and now it kills nearly 20,000 people a year.
Here in America?
In America.
Well, you know, what you just said, though, that I think that is the common wisdom or folktale, that bacteria is everywhere, diseases are everywhere. So why are we so worried about these alleged, quote-unquote, pathogens stemming from industrial farming and the workers who work in those places?
So bacteria are everywhere, and bacteria cause infections all the time in people. But we have antibiotics to cure them, you know, and so they just seem like no big deal. Like urinary tract infections, there's 7 to 8 million urinary tract infections a year in the United States just caused by E. coli. And people shrug them off because, yeah, you take an antibiotic and you're fine. But if that antibiotic fails, that progresses to a kidney infection. A kidney infection can progress to a blood infection. And you can almost flip a coin if you get a blood infection with E. coli, whether you're going to live or die. And if you get that blood infection, you want an antibiotic to work, and you want it to work immediately because you could have 4 hours before you're dead, you know? And so there's, again, it's this arrogance, this complacency built on you know, having grown up in an era when antibiotics were part of our regular medical, you know, reality.
Well, what is it about, before we dive into the paper you all put out, but what is it about antibiotics? What was it that we were missing in the beginning that we're realizing now, and why?
You know what? We've known it since the beginning. So Alexander Fleming discovered penicillin, right? So more than 70 years ago now. And in his Nobel acceptance speech, he said, if we use these wrong, if we use these at the wrong concentrations, we're going to have resistance. He said, you know, I don't know the exact quote, but it was something, you know, it's easy to make these resistant. All you have to do is use them at the wrong dose. That's what we do with 9 billion food animals every year in the United States, 9 billion food animals, and we're feeding them subtherapeutic doses of antibiotics, exactly what Alexander Fleming said would create drug-resistant bacteria, and we do it every day. It's part of production. We're creating superbugs on our farms every day. It's a suicide pact.
But it's been denied. Even the report that you came out with, and I didn't mean to jump to this right away, People in the industry are saying this doesn't prove anything. That these bugs are here. What's the quote? I think the quote was in the Grist article about your study, where it quoted Paul Sundberg, Vice President of Science and Technology for the National Pork Board, said that it's an interesting finding with no human health implications. He believed that the study simply used advanced techniques to confirm what we already know, that Staphylococcus moves from people to animals. He also downplayed the overall threat from pig MRSAs, generally, putting it behind hospital and community-acquired infections as a case of concern.
Right. So currently, he might actually be right in the case of some of the strains of staph that are circulating in the United States today seem more of a threat than this strain of we call livestock MRSA or ST398. But what we see, these things change all the time. So what we're seeing is that this strain that's emerging from livestock is changing before our eyes, and it's becoming more virulent. It's increasing its capacity to cause disease in humans, and we may be just looking at the beginning of an epidemic curve, and hopefully this thing fizzles out and doesn't go anywhere. But we're seeing increasing evidence that it's moving now, not just from animals to people, but from people to people. And once that happens, it's out of our control. And the thing is if you look historically in the United States, we've had MRSA strains, this deadly organism. Some people think it kills more people than HIV today. It kills about 19,000 Americans each year. Wow. MRSA.
Across the world?
No, in the United States.
In the United States.
19,000. Okay. So these strains have come, they've appeared out of nowhere, and they kill lots of people for several years, and then they fizzle out, and then another one comes and replaces it. We don't know where these strains originate. We know that using antibiotics helps to make them successful, and we help that they select for these things. It's a natural selection process. But where are the origins? So now, you know, we haven't been following them in the past like we do now. And so now we're watching, and we see the emergence of a new strain from food animal production. How many times has that happened in the past? We have no idea. But what we're certain of, it's going to happen again in the future if we don't change the way we use antibiotics in food animal production.
So let's go to the heart of the research that you did. Not just you, but this crossed many countries, right?
Right.
The scientists who worked
20,
on this.
20 countries. 19, yeah.
22, was it?
I think it's 19 countries.
Okay, 19, okay, yeah. Right. 19 countries. But let's talk about the significance of it. What I understand, just in terms of layman's understanding, that this was the first time it was shown that this the staphylococcus went from almost, which was relatively harmless, from human beings to animals, back to humans, then out. Is that what we're?
So
was that? Go ahead.
Yeah, very very close. So what this study showed very clearly was that this strain started off as an antibiotic susceptible strain. That is, a strain of staph that could be treated with antibiotics. It spread from humans to animals, livestock. That's where it became resistant to antibiotics. It became resistant to tetracycline and to methicillin, two very important drugs for treating staph infections. And then it started spreading back to people through direct livestock exposure. So this is the first time we're recognizing this complete circle too, right? So it jumps from humans to animals, becomes resistant, and then starts jumping back.
So what is the significance of that, given what we thought, what we didn't know for sure, with any certainty before?
Well, I think one of the really important things is to recognize that these supposed species boundaries, you know, between us and the animals are not as strong as we thought, right? So, you know, we like to think that there are animal bacteria and there are human bacteria, and the animal bacteria stay to themselves and the human bacteria stay to themselves, and there's no real sharing except for, you know, the classic foodborne pathogens like Salmonella and Campylobacter. But now with this study, we recognize that what we thought was pig MRSA, this special strain of pig MRSA, was in fact human staph that became MRSA in pigs and then spread back to people. So you see, so there's this, it's fluid. And we have to understand this concept of one health, right? So what happens in the animals can impact humans and vice versa, right? So we can share these things. But when you have 9 billion food animals in the United States all being treated with antibiotics, you are creating what we call hopeful monsters. You're creating drug-resistant bacteria that maybe most of them end up fizzling out and don't really move anywhere. But occasionally they jump. Occasionally they move into people and they can cause devastating illness. And we're inviting this catastrophe.
But with 19,000 people dying every month.
No, every year. Sorry.
Every year.
Yeah.
Some of the people playing off the research you just did were writing and saying things in blogs and other places that this could be the tip of the iceberg. This could be, we may be opening a Pandora's box of antibiotic resistant diseases, and we have no idea how to handle it, what could come.
Right.
Is that?
So we have opened the Pandora's box. I mean, we open it and we waft it every day in food animal production, right? I mean, opening the Pandora's box in this case is selecting for antibiotic resistant bacteria. So antibiotic selection is what we call it. It's a natural selection process. It's like Darwinian evolution, but in real time. So when you have a population of bacteria, like the bacteria that exist in and on a pig, for instance, there's trillions, literally trillions of bacteria. Some of those can cause disease in you, and some of them cause disease in me. Probably the same ones. That's right. So when we use antibiotics in that animal, when we feed them antibiotics, we're forcing those populations of bacteria to become resistant to those antibiotics. And then if we become infected with that bacterium, then it's already resistant to the very treatment we would need to cure that illness. You know what I mean? So we have opened that Pandora's box, and we can close it again, and we can slow the emergence of these bacteria. But no one seems to have the political will or the business will to close that box again.
A couple things come to mind as you say that. One is that I think you were quoted as saying, "I'm not a veterinarian, but what I see here, if we have to give animals antibiotics just to keep them whole until we can slaughter them, something's wrong."
Right. So exactly. So I think, you know, I've said this before, that if we've engineered a food animal production system that requires a constant input of antibiotics to keep animals alive, we've misengineered the system. It is inherently flawed because we're making sick animals. But it's not even clear to me that that's why they're adding antibiotics. You know, I mean, and in fact, a lot of these antibiotics are approved for what's called growth promotion. So they're using antibiotics to make animals grow faster. They're using our life-saving drugs, these drugs, this gift to mankind, this gift to modern medicine. They're using them as cheap production tools to decrease their costs, knowing that they're creating drug-resistant bacteria that have the potential to infect people, and they continue to do it. And we let them.
Because this is potentially for growth and for protection against diseases animals might get to keep them healthy. In Europe, they've banned the use of antibiotics, if I understand correctly.
For non-therapeutic purposes.
Right.
So in Europe, in the European Union, starting with the Scandinavian countries, they banned all uses except for therapeutics. So if you have a sick animal or even a sick flock of animals or herd, you can treat them with antibiotics. And that's fine there. But what you're not allowed to do is routinely use antibiotics to prevent diseases, because they see it like I see it, that if your system is designed to make animals sick, your system's broken and you need to re-engineer it. And so, you know, they had to change the way they raised animals, right? So they had to decrease the density. They had to clean the houses more frequently. All these things that we would probably consider good things anyway. And the animals actually seem a bit happier. So this is, you know, usually I just stick to the antibiotic resistance thing, but I've been on a pig farm in Denmark. Mm-hmm. And I was getting a tour from a Danish pig farmer. And at one point, it really struck me, because he stepped into the pen with these giant sows, big pigs. And this big pig comes up to him and rubs against him almost like a dog. And he starts rubbing this pig's ear. And he says to me, he said, I love this. I'm a farmer again. it used to be dangerous in here. And now they're so much happier. I can come in here. And so, I mean, I think it's not only good for us, it's also good for them.
You testified in Congress last week. Or not testified, you had a...
congressional briefing.
Briefing. Talk a bit about what happened.
I briefed Congress.
You briefed Congress.
I didn't debrief them.
I could use some debriefing, but yeah. You briefed them. And this was this in connection with Congresswoman Louise Slaughter's bill?
So she has Congress's only microbiologist, right?
Yeah, right.
And public health training, right? So she has both microbiology and public health training. I don't think it's a coincidence that she's the only one who's or one of the major advocates for reducing the use of antibiotics in food animal production. So she has a bill called the Preservation of Antibiotics for Medical Treatment Act, or PAMTA. And, you know, this is – I think it's a very conservative bill. I mean, I don't think it goes nearly far enough. I support it because it's a good step forward. And basically what it says is you cannot use – or let's put it in the positive. So you can only use antibiotics for sick animals. So you can't use them for growth promotion. You can't use them for routine disease prevention. So it's not a radical bill, and it doesn't take any specific classes of antibiotics out of the equation. And that's where I think it doesn't go far enough. I think we should be saving some antibiotics just for human health. I mean, well, look, we're not discovering new ones, and they're losing their utility. And the more we use them, the less they're going to work. And so we need to protect some. And so I wish that it had some protected. But anyway, it's a good bill. It's a good step forward, and it bans all non-therapeutic use of antibiotics. Well, you would think that we're proposing to make school-age boys wear skirts to school. I mean, it's some sort of radical movement to only use antibiotics in sick animals. I mean, can you go to Rite Aid and buy a 50-pound bag of tetracycline?
Right.
You can't, but you can go to a feed you can go to a feed store and buy a bag of tetracycline without any prescription. I can go into a feed store on the Eastern Shore of Maryland and buy a bag of tetracycline without any kind of identification. I mean,
The same tetracycline you or I would use, or it might be prescribed to us.
Yeah, same drugs. Isn't that crazy?
So, you said the bill, and one where you said this was a fairly conservative bill.
Yeah.
Why do you call it a fairly conservative bill?
Well, because it's a gradual phasing out of just non-therapeutic antibiotics. So growth promotion and routine disease prevention. You're still allowed to use every major class of antibiotics for treating sick animals. And in my mind, there's nothing radical about this bill. And in fact, like I said, I would like to see some more aggressive stances. I would like to see maybe the third generation cephalosporin, some of our last really good drugs, protected only for human health. But that's not what this bill does. This bill just says, all right, use antibiotics only in sick animals.
So given the research, given the paper you all just published, the research you just given to the public, how is that related to the idea that antibiotics made for human beings, especially these new antibiotics being built, or that there's a danger in using them discriminately or indiscriminately with animals in large-scale food production?
Right. So, again, what our study showed was that we started off with methicillin-susceptible Staph aureus in people. It gets introduced to livestock, and it's only after it gets introduced to livestock that it becomes resistant to tetracycline, and it becomes resistant to methicillin, two very important drugs. And these are also and tetracycline is widely used in food animal production. And then in food animal production, we also use third-generation cephalosporins that can select for MRSA, methicillin-resistant Staph aureus. And so it's very clear evidence that it's in food animal production, and it's because of antibiotic use in food animal production that we're making these superbugs. And then, again, they're wrapping back and infecting people now. And so, you know, it's clear evidence that we're creating these pathogens. And before, I think most of our clear evidence was related to the classic, what I call the classic foodborne pathogens, the Salmonellas and the Campylobacter. So each of, you know, Salmonella and Campylobacter cause, you know, together cause a couple of million infections in the United States each year, foodborne infections. So it's, you know, the diarrhea, the classic foodborne infections. And we have unequivocal, clear scientific evidence for decades showing that drug-resistant strains of Salmonella and Campylobacter emerged from antibiotic use in food animal production. So, right, we created them there. And then those go on to cause drug-resistant infections in people. Well, luckily with Campylobacter and Salmonella, we get diarrhea, we're sick, and then we usually, it's self-limiting. In other words, we usually feel better after a few days without the need of medication. But when your immune system doesn't fight it off, you absolutely do need antibiotics to prevent that from becoming a serious invasive infection and getting in your blood, in other words, and killing you. And if your immune system's weak, you need that antibiotic. And so while we had really good data showing this link before with those two organisms, this is the first time we've seen this really good link with Staph aureus, you know, one of the major killers around the world.
So everything I've read about this, I mean, there's always been a lot of conjecture about the danger of large animal productions where animals are held in tight, confined quarters. But again, to kind of reiterate what we were talking about earlier, I mean, the idea that a treatable infection brought from human beings to pigs, in this case, transferred back to people into community. That again, this is what some of the magazines, the Grist and others, called your smoking gun.
Right.
Something we did not know before this study came out.
Right.
Right?
Yeah. I saw that the Grist called it the smoking gun. I don't know if it's the smoking gun, but that gun's hot for sure.
my question was going to be, is it really a smoking gun, or is this like the beginning of something that should allow us to do the kind of research that makes this connection so that policy can change?
Well, you know, my job is doing good, solid science, you know, and so I try to design robust studies, and that's what I've done here. And, yeah, really good evidence that we created a superbug because of antibiotic use in food animal production. You know, at the same time, I'm very well versed on the research, and I've been studying this for years, right? And I've seen enough good data to know that we need to do something now. I'm going to continue to do good research, but in the meantime, we've got to do something to protect these drugs. And maybe that's straight out of self-preservation. I want to live in a world where antibiotics work. I don't have kids, but if I have kids, I want them to grow up in a world that has antibiotics that work. And we're barreling towards a time when our antibiotics don't work. And we're not discovering new antibiotics. You know, we used to discover new antibiotics every few years, right? We're not doing that anymore. In the meantime, bacteria are becoming resistant to our antibiotics very quickly. So our current antibiotics are losing their utility, and we're not discovering new ones. We're in a bad situation in public health. This is one of the greatest threats to public health that we face today.
So what were the questions of skepticism you received, if I can ask, in the House when you spoke to a group of congressional leaders about this research?
I didn't hear any skepticism. I mean, I saw a couple of people in the audience that I know have financial conflicts, but and they didn't look happy, but they didn't speak up.
That's interesting. It's interesting.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think we continue to close gaps. You know, we have clear evidence from Denmark showing that we were able to remove growth-promoting antibiotics without having any net negative impact on the food animal industry. So there were dire consequences predicted there. You know, the farmers, the food animal producers, they said, you can't do this. You're going to destroy our industry, just like we hear here all the time. So people say this, you know, you're going to destroy the industry. Well, what happened there? This is Denmark is one of the world's, if not the greatest, or the largest exporter of pork. They're between one and two, the first and second exporter of pork. So they compete with pork products on a global market. with very high labor costs, and yet they were able to remove growth-promoting antibiotics and still, since that time, increase the size of their pork production by 40%. They saw no net loss in productivity. They saw no, over time, no increase in mortality, and continued to grow their industry by 40%. Same with chicken production. Chicken production, no impact on either mortality in the chickens or in productivity. So they just continued to make a good, safe product.
So what's the next phase of this research for you? I mean, where do you take this now?
Well, so what we're doing is we're looking at one of the things that our research revealed was that there's this in the livestock associated resistant strains. We see some that look like they're particularly virulent. That is, they have an increased ability to colonize people and possibly cause disease. And so we're monitoring that new lineage of MRSA to see if it's actually now moving from person to person. We see some evidence that it's switching gears. So as I said before, we can almost always trace, maybe I didn't say this before, but we could always trace these multi-drug resistant strains back to livestock exposure. So we found a person with this livestock-associated MRSA strain, and we could always find, if we asked them questions, we could always trace them back to either direct or indirect exposure to livestock. Now we're finding examples of people where they don't have that exposure. And so it looks like this organism, this strain, is shifting gears. So it may be passed from person to person, or maybe there's a meat source. So we know that the food's contaminated with this strain as well. And we have no idea what the risk of Staph aureus infection from meat is. And not in the United States. We've never done the studies.
You mean meat that we would buy from a grocery store?
Yeah. Yeah, so I've done studies looking at Staph aureus and retail meat and poultry in the United States. 40% of pork, beef, and chicken are contaminated with Staph aureus. Nearly 80% of ground turkey is contaminated with Staph aureus. And more than half of that is multi-drug resistant, so that is resistant to three or more antibiotics. And yet we have never done any studies to evaluate the human health risk of that contamination. So and it's a different risk. So I think we have to change what we think of as foodborne risks now. So I don't think that this staph is going to cause diarrhea, but what if you handle that contaminated meat? What if you have a cut on your hand? These staph causes skin and soft tissue infections. Can you get an infection from handling this? What if you're a prep cook handling, you know, thousands of chicken breasts in a day? You know, what's your risk? We don't know. We're doing a giant experiment with the American public. And you know, nobody's doing anything about it.
Now, given the kind of the work we're doing now, is there a difference between, well, I'm going to take that back. Is there something about the way we raise animals in large scale production in small spaces that has to do with the development of these diseases as opposed to people who raise them in grazing them with a lot of space, with no antibiotics given to them? Is there a difference, or is this a supposition people just like to think there's a difference?
So if you go to the CDC website and you read about MRSA, methicillin-resistant Staph aureus, they'll talk about the five C's of MRSA transmission. So the five C's are crowding, frequent skin-to-skin contact, another C, compromised skin, like cuts or abrasions, contaminated items and surfaces, and lack of cleanliness. So those are the five C's of MRSA transmission. That's what the CDC tells us will increase the transmission of staph and MRSA. And they name some locations where the five C's are common. They include schools, dormitories, military barracks, households, daycare centers. But they don't talk about CAFOs. There's no concentrated animal feeding operation. There's no place where the five C's are more prevalent than a concentrated animal feeding operation, the very places where we're raising our meat and poultry. And then we introduce the magic ingredient of antibiotics. I've been a microbiologist for more than 16 years. I promise you, I could not engineer a better system for creating drug-resistant bacteria than to introduce antibiotics to a concentrated animal feeding operation. These are antibiotic-resistant bacteria machines. We are making these things there.
So the scenario you're painting, the research paints, is pretty foreboding. I mean, in terms of what could be happening, that we don't know. We just don't know.
Well, let me tell you what we do know. We do know that the way we raise our animals today is creating drug-resistant bacteria. We know this unequivocally. Clear evidence. When we introduce antibiotics to our concentrated animal feeding operations, we're going to create drug-resistant bacteria. And we know that the environment, the concentrated, the CAFO environment, the animals themselves, the meat products that come from them, they're all contaminated with drug-resistant bacteria. That's what we know. And we know in some cases, in the case of Salmonella and Campylobacter, that these are causing drug-resistant bacteria, drug-resistant infections in people. What we don't know is what the human health risks of these other bacteria are. What about the extra intestinal pathogenic E. coli that we find in our food supply? And this organism causes tens of thousands of deaths in the United States, causes millions of urinary tract infections. We find it on 20% of our poultry products, and yet we don't know what fraction of those deaths, of those infections in humans, might be coming from those poultry products, right? So there are things that we know. You know, we're creating the bacteria, they're there, but in some cases we don't know what fraction of the human diseases they're causing.
That was Dr. Lance Price from the Translational Genomics Research Institute in Flagstaff, Arizona. You're listening to Soundbites on Delmarva, and don't go away, because we'll be right back after this very short break. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information, www.mecu.com. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland Parkinson's Disease and Movement Disorders Center, providing clinical research trials that evaluate new therapies and the latest treatment options, including surgical intervention for advancing stages of disease. The number for more information is 1-800-492-5538. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, host of Soundbites on Delmarva. This week, we're talking about the drugs we feed our farm animals and how the use of those drugs affects human health. Up next, Dr. Keith Nachman joins us to talk about a bill that just passed the Maryland General Assembly that bans certain drugs in poultry feed in the state of Maryland. Dr. Nachman is the head of the Farming for the Future program at the Center for a Livable Future and is assistant scientist at the Environmental Health Sciences Department at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health.
So one of the top things on our agenda clearly is, we'll be covering a great deal, is the arsenic bill that passed the House and the Senate in Annapolis and is about to go to the governor's desk. But there's complexities to it. Before we get to the complexity, let's take a step backwards and tell me about what this bill means and what's gone to his desk.
Okay. So this bill, until it was amended in the 11th hours of the various chambers of the Maryland General Assembly, would ban the use of arsenical drugs from use in Maryland's poultry production. There had been a number of scientific studies that had looked at the downstream consequences of using arsenic to raise poultry. A number of studies had identified risks to people who may consume chicken that had been raised using Roxarsone or any of the other arsenical drugs, because the use of those drugs leads to residues of arsenic in chicken meat and in chicken liver. There have also been a number of studies conducted by a wide range of universities and federal agencies that had determined that using the drug leads to the environmental deposition of massive quantities of inorganic arsenic over its period of use.
Now talk about what – let's just define that. When people say that, because people can go, what does that mean, massive quantities? And some person's massive quantity is just a minute quantity to somebody else. So what do you mean by massive quantities of arsenic? And what has it done to us or our land from your perspective?
We're talking about tons per year. By calculations that we'd done using data on roxurcin usage that's provided to us by the trade associations for the poultry industry, and data from Alpharma, the drugs manufacturer, we were able to estimate that each year the use of roxurcin in Maryland's poultry industry led to about 30 metric tons of arsenic being deposited into Maryland's environment each year. And arsenic is an elemental compound, which means that it doesn't go away on its own. It has to go somewhere. So what happens is that the majority of the arsenic that was administered to the birds ends up in poultry waste or poultry litter, as a lot of people like to call it. And we manage that litter primarily by applying it to agricultural land as fertilizer. And what happens to the arsenic is it actually competes with phosphorus, which is very present in poultry waste for soil binding sites. And what that really means is that it becomes free to move off-site. And what it can do is it can accumulate in surface water, and there are concerns that it may also accumulate in groundwater, although that's very difficult to demonstrate.
Why is this so difficult?
Because arsenic is naturally occurring in geologic formations, so arsenic can be present in...
So isn't that one of the arguments people make all the time, that why this is not as dangerous as we seem to make it, because it is a natural formation? Isn't that one of the arguments made a lot?
Right, and that's sort of a different discussion. But yes, arsenic is naturally occurring in geologic formations, and it is an element. Arsenic itself is not a synthetic compound. But whether or not a compound is natural has very little to do with how bad it is for people. There are a number of naturally occurring compounds like lead and mercury that are very, very bad for people. So natural is not a good benchmark for whether or not you'd want to be associated or exposed to something.
I'm sorry, I interrupted you in the stream of another thought. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. So we were talking about arsenic in groundwater.
Right,
so
right.
So it's difficult to tell whether arsenic that's present in groundwater is solely due to natural contamination, or it may have something to do with the spreading of poultry waste in agricultural land. But regardless, again, I mentioned that we spread about 30 metric tons of arsenic each year on Maryland soils, and as a result, it has to go somewhere. So some of it's sticking behind in the soil, some of it may be accumulating in surface water, and some of it may get into groundwater. But arsenic is a very well-characterized human carcinogen, and it's absolutely essential that we take any measure we can, especially measures that don't cost us anything, to avoid human exposure.
So, but now this bill is going to the desk, House Bill 167, it's a Senate name as well.
I can't remember the Senate
name.
Yeah,
but it's going to his desk. It's passed both houses.
Mm-hmm.
And that was something huge for me and people. People did not think it was going to come out of the Senate committee at all. It was going to be held up once again, but it did hit the floor and it passed.
I was surprised, but I was pleasantly surprised that it did pass, although it ended up being amended.
Yeah, this amendment. Now, this is something I'm sitting here looking at a chart, right? I guess you can figure it out by if you took a chemistry class, you'd know exactly what we're looking at here. But roxazone is what was banned.
Mm-hmm.
Nitazone was not. Now, when you look at the chart, it looks as the elements have shifted a little. But that shift, you're saying, is significant in some levels.
Oh, no, I'm saying the shift is, from a human health perspective, is insignificant.
Insignificant.
Right. So should we back up? So the bill was amended at the very last minute in the Senate, and then this amendment was also approved in the House that would exempt one of the arsenical drugs from the ban in Maryland. So roxurcin, which previously had been the most commonly used arsenical drug, is banned, assuming the governor signs on Monday. And that should certainly be recognized as a public health victory. However, it's important to think about the consequences of this amendment and the potential loophole it may create. So the amendment excludes nitazone from the ban, which is a different arsenical drug that's also marketed by the Pfizer Pharmaceutical Company. And nitazone is approved for use in chickens and turkeys. So while anecdotally I've heard that nitazone is more expensive than roxurcin, and that would explain why roxurcin was much more commonly used prior to roxurcin's suspension from the market, we suspect that nitazone may replace it on the market.
So what does that mean? I mean, how does that – does it in effect mean things haven't changed?
It's tough to assess how much the industry will decide to, or to what extent the industry will decide to replace roxurcin with nitazone, but they are certainly able to do so, and the FDA has not passed any regulations or put together any rules that would prohibit the use of nitazone in poultry production. And frankly, from my perspective, looking at how tough of a battle it was to have nitazone excluded from the legislation that just passed, it would indicate that the industry is likely to use it.
So I'm confused. I think people who are listening to this would be confused. So, I mean, I'm sitting here with you and they can't see the chart, but I can see there's a shift, I guess, in the
the nitro group.
Right?
Yes.
So what does that mean? I mean, so how does it change, how does it make nitrosone different than roxazone in terms of what its compounds are, what it's made of, and what it does in the soil?
Chemically, it's very, very similar. The shift in the nitro group has virtually no consequence with regard to some of the public health concerns over the drug. There's still the arsenic functional group that has been demonstrated in the scientific literature to be converted by bacteria in the soil and by light into inorganic arsenic. And it is likely, based on the similarity of the chemical structures, that that will also occur with nitrosone.
But you've not done tests on nitrosone.
I haven't, so I can't say with certainty. But it appears likely based on looking at the chemical structures.
So it was a huge step forward to have roxazone banned
yes.
from use. But this nitrosone clearly was something that some people in the agriculture community and the industry wanted to see remain available for use in agriculture in the state of Maryland.
Yes.
So now, all right, well, that's interesting. I mean, yeah. It leaves kind of a question mark dangling.
It does. I mean, it appears to be a loophole. You know, my understanding of the origins of the amendment and the exemption for nitrosone was Maryland's very small turkey industry that had been reported to have previously used nitrosone. But upon further investigation, it turns out that the FDA has approved nitrosone for use in chickens as well. So prior to roxazone's suspension from the market, you know, we may not have expected to see much use of nitrosone. But now that roxazone is unavailable, if the industry wants to use an arsenical drug, nitrosone is available. So it seems likely that they may use it. Again, I can't speak to their feed formulations. It's not something they ever share with anyone outside of the companies. And, you know, it speaks to the degree of consumer knowledge or uncertainty about what's being fed to food that they plan to eat.
Because we still don't know what really makes up what goes into the feed that we feed the poultry that we raise.
Absolutely. The only way you'll ever know what's in poultry feed is if the poultry company tells you, we do not use this.
You can't take that feed and analyze it and see what's in it?
You can, but that requires you to get access to the feed,
uh-huh.
which is not something that we've been afforded in the past.
You can't just go to the store and buy it.
Unfortunately, you can't. You can buy – well, I take that back. You can go to a feed store and buy feed, but you're not going to buy feed from another integrator. You know, they do not sell their proprietary feed in a feed store. So it would be tough to know what any one integrator company uses without having them voluntarily give you feed to say, hey, here, test our feed. And I don't see that happening in the near future.
One of the other things that we always thought was that roxazone was only made by Pfizer,
mm-hmm.
correct? But now you have some research has said that many people are producing roxazone.
Well, we have to be cautious with that document. So in doing a little bit of background investigation on nitrosone, I came across an FDA document of approved drugs and trade names and their associated manufacturers or drug sponsors, which means the company that's responsible for selling or marketing the drug. And I was looking for roxazone, and I was fairly surprised to find that other drug manufacturers are – have active approvals for roxazone. Now, this should not matter in Maryland because roxazone is banned, so they will still not be able to market that
right.
drug here. However, because those active approvals are on the books, I can't say with certainty that they are marketing these drugs, but I certainly would like to know more about whether those other non-Pfizer pharmaceutical manufacturers and marketers are marketing those drugs in other states. And the interesting sort of backstory to that is in January of 2012, Pfizer was hit with a lawsuit by a Chinese manufacturer who apparently was the one supplying it with the roxazone. I believe it was a $20 million lawsuit. And I haven't heard anything about that case since then. But the lawsuit was over a loss of market share in North America. So if there is a Chinese manufacturer who is selling the drug and they're not able to sell it to Pfizer, there are a number of other companies that have FDA approval to market the drug in the States. So I can't help but worry or wonder if any of those other companies are marketing the drug. Again, I can't say with any certainty that they are, but it's a question that I think should be answered.
So how does this fit into the what just came out from your most recent research? Just talk a bit about that.
So we had some recent research. I think arsenic is only one very small piece of the pie, but it's interesting. So we are always interested to learn about what types of drugs or compounds are fed to food animals, because I am very interested in what people encounter when they eat meat. And we ended up looking at something that's kind of an unorthodox way of trying to figure out what might be used in animal feed. So when we are interested in studying people and learning about what people might have been exposed to in recent times, we do something called biomonitoring, where we look at certain human tissues as indicators of what people might have come into contact with. And one common type of biomonitoring involves looking at human fingernails or human hair as indicators of prior exposure. Chicken feathers are high in keratin, and they're very similar to human fingernails and hair. So we came up with the idea of looking at feathers, more specifically feather meal, as an indicator of the exposure of chickens to various compounds.
Feather meal is what?
So feather meal is chicken feathers that have been heated up to kill bacteria and then chopped very finely into a sort of dusty product that is then added back into feed of various food animal feeds. So chicken feed, swine feed, cattle feed, fish feed, and it's also marketed as an organic fertilizer. So we were able to get 12 samples of poultry feather meal, and we tested them for a variety of different compounds. One of the compounds we tested them for was arsenic. And sure enough, we found arsenic in every sample of the poultry feather meal we tested. It was quite a range of concentrations. And we wanted to figure out what form of arsenic was present in the feathers, because there is quite a bit of debate over the more toxic form of arsenic. It's universally believed that the inorganic forms of arsenic are the most toxic to people, and we found that the inorganic form of arsenic was the dominant form that was present in all of our feather meal samples. There's a little bit of debate over some of the organic forms that haven't been well characterized in literature. But anyways, we found inorganic arsenic in all of the samples, in some cases at quite higher concentrations than others. But I think what was more exciting about the study of feathers is that we found a variety of antibiotics. So we found antibiotic residues in all of the feathers. And in each feather meal sample, we found between 2 and 10 different antibiotics. The most stunning finding in the feathers were residues of fluoroquinolone drugs.
Which means what?
Well, fluoroquinolone drugs were banned from use in poultry in 2005.
And these feathers came from when?
We bought them in late 2010.
So you're assuming that these chicken feathers were from recently slaughtered chickens?
I would assume so.
Right.
And chickens are only kept alive for a handful of weeks, about 6 weeks. So it was especially surprising to us to find samples, residues of 4 different fluoroquinolones in the feather meal samples. And what that says to us is that there is a possibility that the industry is continuing to use these drugs that were banned in 2005. We can't say with certainty that they are, but I really struggle to find an alternate explanation as to why we would have found the fluoroquinolones in the feathers.
As a scientist and as a researcher, you all speak the same way. I can't say with certainty that it is.
It's true. We have to be very careful.
You do. That's all right. But why do you hedge it that way?
It's honest. I can't say with certainty, but what I can say is it's the simplest explanation as to why we found them there. We found them in most of the samples. We found them in samples from 4 different states and in two samples we had from China. And we found different drugs. And one of the
states are they?
We found them in samples from Oregon, California, Idaho, and Tennessee. And we also found them in both samples from China.
All right. So.
And the reason why fluoroquinolones were banned is that there were increasing concerns over the development of resistance to antibiotics among bacteria that were isolated from chicken products called Campylobacter.
Which means that you're talking about the antibiotics we would take as human beings.
Yes. So many of the same antibiotics that are used to treat people are used at very low doses to make food animals grow faster.
And we become resistant to them because we eat the chicken.
Well, the bacteria become resistant to them because they encounter them on farms. And then when we become infected with those bacteria, it's very, very challenging to treat those infections in hospitals. And in some cases, they are untreatable and people die. But in most cases, when you have a resistant infection, it's very, very expensive to treat and it takes a longer time in the hospital.
So what this would mean would be that people were illegally feeding or giving their poultry flocks antibiotics.
It could mean that.
It could mean, excuse me, yes. It could mean that.
It could mean that.
It could mean that. It could mean what then if it wasn't that? What could it mean? Could it mean that this was just residue left over from old feed, that this was...
It shouldn't be old feed. And again, you know, the birds are only kept alive for a short period of
right.
time. So it seems highly unlikely that feathers that we bought in 2010 would be from birds that were much older. I really struggle to come up with an alternate explanation. And again, if we'd found a residue in a single sample, then I might dismiss it as maybe there's some other unusual explanation.
Right.
But we found it in 6 out of 10 of the American samples and in both of the Chinese samples. And again, across 4 different states. So it speaks more to a trend rather than, a single incident.
Could it be that the Chinese samples are sold here in America? I mean, that the Chinese feed is sold here?
Well, we bought it in America. We bought it from an online vendor. So we know they are sold here. And we know that we import some feather meal from China for use in American food animal production.
Could that be the root of it?
It could be. Yes, it could be. But it seems unlikely that you'd see accumulation in the feathers to a detectable level if they were being exposed only through the feather meal from China.
So what has been the response to the report?
It's been a much more substantial response than I would have expected. I think
substantial in terms of support, substantial in terms of being attacked?
Both. We've had quite a bit of support. It's been fairly controversial. I think I was surprised to see a lot of misinterpretation of our findings in the media, which has been a little bit unfortunate.
Likewise,
some of the news stations that I've spoken with have asked about our findings in bird muscle tissue or in bird meat, and we didn't look at chicken meat. We looked at feathers as an indicator of what the animals were fed. So I was a little surprised by that. I think it's great that there's an increased awareness of controversy over what we may be feeding food animals, especially when we're talking about banned drugs. But some of the drugs that we found are not things that are banned, although I think they're things that the general public didn't recognize may be fed to food animals. We found acetaminophen, which is the active ingredient in Tylenol. We found diphenhydramine, which is the active ingredient in Benadryl. We found fluoxetine in the Chinese samples, which is the active ingredient in Prozac. And again, we don't have enough data here to say with certainty that these things are fed to food animals, but why else would we expect to find them in the feed? And I think what it really highlights is the greater point that consumers don't know what their food animals are being fed, and they have no way of finding out that information. And I, as a researcher, have no way of finding out that information other than acquiring samples of feathers and using analytical chemistry to figure out what's in them.
It would be your argument that we should know that we have a right to know what's in the feed. But how would that help us when we buy our chicken?
I could make a decision to not purchase chicken that's been raised using drugs that I disagree with in production processes, for example. I think producers would be less likely to use drugs if they were required to report the use of those drugs on the labels of the package of chicken.
And interesting what you said about the being questioned about the meat, because your research hasn't gone there. Your research is just trying to tell us what drugs are there, what drugs we know they're in the feed the chickens. That's another body of research I have to do.
What drugs are in the feathers? Right,
the feathers. I mean the feathers. So it would be a whole other body of research. Is it as important a body of research to find out what's in the meat?
Oh, absolutely. And that seems like a logical next step for us.
Well, we'll stay on this with you, Keith. This is always a pleasure to talk to you.
Yeah, likewise.
That was Dr. Keith Nachman, head of the Farming for the Future program at the Center for a Livable Future, an assistant scientist at the Environmental Health Sciences Department, the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. I'm your host, Mark Steiner, and thanks for joining us for Soundbites on Delmarva today. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Justin Levy and Christina Arison. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, hear additional interviews, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland Mortgage Program, a community lending initiative of the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development. 1-800-638-7781.